News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Wednesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We're going to be talking about three different books today, all intended for young readers. We'll start out with a conversation with best-selling author Valerie Tripp, talking about the latest installment in her very popular Izzy Newton series. Then we'll be hearing an interview that first aired earlier this year, talking about a really touching book called The Proudest Color. Finally, out of the archives from 2007, a look at one of the great classics by Dr. Seuss, How the Grinch Stole Christmas. Here's part one. And we welcome you to the morning show on WGTD. And this portion of the program is going to be spent with a very, very popular writer who is back in business with the Izzy Newton and Smart Squad series, which has garnered all kinds of attention. Valerie Tripp, also part of the team behind the well-known and popular American Girl series. And in these books devoted to Izzy Newton and the Smart Squad, she is finding all kinds of exciting and intriguing ways to fold STEM, traditions and disciplines, into the lives of some middle school students who engage in all kinds of adventures and use their knowledge and skills and background in STEM to solve those issues and problems. And we have Valerie Tripp with us on the phone to talk about her latest book, which is Izzy Newton and the Smart Squad, Newton's Flaw. And by the way, this comes from National Geographic Kids. Valerie Tripp, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Thank you, Greg. It's wonderful to be back.
Glad we can have this conversation. Ahead of us talking about this book series, let's find out a little bit about your own relationship to science. That is, from, for instance, your middle school years, have you been someone who's been really interested in science, and do you come to these writing efforts with a pretty strong background?
No. And I think that's one of the reasons why I wrote the books, because one of the things I wanted to do for my readers was something I wish somebody had done for me when I was in middle school, which was to say, you know, science doesn't only happen in labs by people wearing goggles and white coats. You are a scientist already. If you are, let's say you're training your pet to fetch a ball and bring it back to you, that's biology. That is science. Let's say you like to stir up, you know, a batch of brownies. That's chemistry. That's science. You know, let's say you and your friends decide you're going to build a treehouse or something. That's engineering. That's science. And so one of my huge motivations in writing Izzy Newton and the Smart Squad books was to say, you're already a scientist. We're all surrounded by science all the time. In fact, I think science is an active verb. I think it's a way of looking at the world and being in the world and interacting with the world. So the answer to your question is, I didn't think I was anyway, but I wanted to say to young readers, all of us are scientists living, if we're curious and engaged and involved, are all scientists. Hmm.
We also hear quite a lot, we used to hear about this even more years ago, the fact that by and large, it seemed to be difficult to attract girls into the sciences, that that many of them would...
Yes, unfortunately, yes, and still, you know, at the higher levels of engineering, for example, the women are only about 20% of engineering classes at higher levels. And that's another huge motivation for this series, to say to girls, pursue this. There's no gender coding about science. You pursue this. If you're interested in any of these STEM fields, science, technology, engineering, and math, you stick to it. Here's another thing that we've learned, Greg, as we've gone along. Women have actually made incredibly important discoveries and incredibly important contributions, but we're not given credit for them in the past. And so that's another reason for young girls to assert themselves as scientists and join these fields.
Which is all the more reason for the main protagonist of your books to be one Izzy Newton. And, of course, that's one one reason for us to seek these books out. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Valerie Tripp, who, in addition to creating the American Girl series of books, has now created a new series called Izzy Newton and the Smart Squad. And the latest book, which has just come out, is called Newton's Flaw. By the way, you should explain to our listeners what smart in the word smart squad refers to.
Yes, smart stands for solving mysteries and revealing truths. And that, for example, in Newton's Flaw, I use a scientific phenomenon as not only the inspiration for the story, but also kind of a metaphor. In Newton's Flaw, there's a flaw, a crack, a fissure in the school building caused by hydrostatic pressure, and the water seeping up into the library has created mold. And that's the mystery and the problem that the girls have to discover and resolve. There's also a crack, a fissure, and a division within the squad itself. So Newton's flaw, that word flaw, is a metaphor for something that's going on interpersonally among the five girls. I also use the word flaw. Izzy Newton has a flaw herself, which is she hates public speaking. And she has to learn a way to deal with that flaw as well. In all cases, I try to use the title kind of as a pun, kind of as a metaphor, and a way for the science to bounce off of and be inspired by. Or, I loved the verb that you used, sort of fold in the science and the interpersonal. And I loved that verb that you used there, fold. And I'm so indebted to a group of middle school girls I've been meeting with. I call them my lunch bunch, and they are particularly helpful to me for keeping the story authentic. They model group interaction for me. They give me specific ideas for plots. It was their idea that Izzy's flaw was that she hated to stand up in front of a group because they don't like to do that, and then they gave me specific ideas for ways Izzy could sort of bridge over that flaw, find a solution to her problem. They inspire me specifically, and also they inspire me just kind of, I don't know what word to use, maybe just globally, because being with them is so invigorating. They just seem to me the personification of, you know, promise and potential. I love spending time with middle schoolers.
Gives you hope for the future.
Yes, it does. That's exactly right, Greg.
One of the centerpieces of the plot of Newton's Flaw is an upcoming science fair that has the Smart Squad very, very excited. And I really appreciate the fact that this is such a significant element in the story because, of course, some of us have never had the pleasure of being part of that, but surely we've seen at least passing images in various films and television series and so on of what goes on at science fairs and how sometimes they can be absolutely wondrous in terms of the kind of things that are explored. Was your lunch bunch helpful to you, or otherwise, how did you find out kind of what this world of science fairs is like? Because it seems like you present it very authentically.
Well, I remember science fairs when I was growing up, and I remembered science fairs at my daughter's school, and specifically in Newton's Law, I was very helped by a science class that I Zoomed with during the pandemic. I would Zoom with classes and students, and I spoke to them about their science fair and what projects they did. And they gave me an idea for a project that Izzy and her friends try to do. And I'm going to tell you, Greg, Izzy and the Smart Squad Science Fair project literally blows up in their face. Literally explodes. And they have to, at the last minute, they don't even have 24 hours to come up with a brand new project. And this at Seneca River Middle School in Virginia, that class said to me, oh, here's what we did for our science fair. It's so brilliant, Greg, so I just used it in the book. What they did was they gave everybody a bathing cap, and then they drew brains on the bathing caps. That was their science fair project. Is that not fabulous? So true, when I say that middle schoolers give me inspiration, I'm not kidding. They gave me the solution to my plot problem, and they gave Izzy and their friends a solution to their last-minute science fair project problem.
Right. Another element of the plot for Newton's Flaw, I think we've maybe mentioned it briefly, is that this strange illness kind of rears its ugly head, and that it is a mystery that needs to be solved in terms of what exactly is the nature of this illness. Did that plot point have anything to do with, for instance, this pandemic we're all living through, and you know, kind of the scary specter of widespread illness in a setting like a school?
Yes, it absolutely did. It absolutely did. And you know, during the pandemic, is it wrong to say it was inspiring that I realized all of us were immersed in the science, whether we liked it or not? We were kind of subjects in the scientific experiment, were we not? And so, yes, I thought, how can I bring this home even more to the middle school students? Yes, I thought they would identify very much with a mysterious illness pervading their school, their school building. And I could have the sort of vicarious triumph of having my group of characters solve that problem. If only that kind of thing could happen in real life.
Exactly. Another strand of the story involves Izzy Newton getting up the courage to try out for the otherwise all-boys hockey team. And even in this arena, science enters the fray, so to speak, because she begins to understand, for instance, things like gravity and how they matter. And we get the sense that some of her scientific know-how helps her, in a sense, weather some of the initial frustrations and fears that would be part of taking that up.
She's a physicist, you know, and she actually is familiar with Newton's laws of motion, for example. So she brings those into play, and she and her brothers develop this trick shot that just can't be beat because she is aware of Newton's laws of motion, and so she knows it. She takes advantage of her physics knowledge and puts that to work in ice hockey. And I can take no credit for that whatsoever. I was having a conversation with my grandniece, Helen, who plays ice hockey, and she was the one who opened my eyes to this crossover between physics and ice hockey and being a girl on an ice hockey team. When I say that inspiration comes from all over and comes from my readers and my middle schoolers, I'm not kidding. Helen was the one who explained all of this to me. This is one of the things I love about this series, is that it's as if, you know, the universe was full of the information I needed. I just needed to wake up and go looking for it. I just needed to be sort of alerted to it. And it is all out there. And I love the way that I love the interaction between the science, the ice hockey, you know, so therefore sports, and the interpersonal stuff. I love the way all of those are folded together.
I'm curious how complex you can make a book like this for middle school readers. That is, how many different strands of plot can be woven together, and what goes into your thinking or your calculations in terms of how complicated to make a story?
Boy, is that a great question. Is that a great, great, great question. I'm going to kind of take a little step back to say that in college, I decided to major in philosophy. I wanted to get my money's worth out of going to college and be, you know, instructed and how to read things I couldn't understand on my own. And here's how I did it. I would kind of translate really complicated philosophical complex concepts into language I could understand. That's how I made it through as a philosophy major at Yale. Then I put that same skill to work, writing for American Girl, taking kind of complicated historical and sociological concepts and kind of distilling them, translating them in there so that I could communicate them in the clearest possible way. And that's what I have tried to do in these books for Izzy Newton, take a complicated scientific concept and distill it and discipline myself to express it as clearly as I can and almost as concretely as I can for my readers and make it so it is present to them. That is my challenge. You have absolutely pinpointed my challenge because I can do research about hydrostatic pressure from, you know, and talk to scientists who deal with it, but it's my job to write it in such a way that not only does it make sense to my reader, who's probably 10, 11, 12 years old and probably coming into contact with that concept for the first time, it has to matter to my reader. It has to be part of my plot. It has to be something that they go, ooh, what is the Smart Squad going to do to solve this? So you have absolutely pinpointed my both joy and challenge, I will say, in writing these books.
I'm reminded of something I just heard this morning as we're recording this, something that playwright Sarah Rule said about the process of transforming her play Eurydice into an opera libretto that the Metropolitan Opera is doing right now. And she said in the course of this interview something that really surprised me, that she loves the process of cutting because, of course, it takes a lot longer to sing things than to speak things. So she had to drastically cut back her play. And she said she loves that process because you end up getting to the heart of things when you figure out what can be let go of and what must be retained. And in a sense, you have to do that as well if you want to make this a book that has the kind of focus that's going to really connect with a middle school reader. You have to make sure that there's nothing here that is kind of extraneous or doesn't need to be there.
And you know what helps me tremendously is the wonderful, gorgeous illustrations by Geneva Bowers. I know it's a cliche to say, you know, a picture's worth a thousand words, but Geneva's illustrations are about a million's words worth because she lifts the burden of some of the explanation, of some of the mood off of me. After the illustrations come in the writing process, when the illustrations come back from Geneva, I can take my metaphorical pencil and delete a lot of the inner thought, a lot of the explanation, because Geneva has captured what is going on in the group way better than I could with words. And the other brilliant thing Geneva's illustrations do is they bring kind of a lightness. They bring kind of a whimsy, sort of a feeling of motion and energy and joy to the stories that add a whole other 100%. I learn a tremendous amount from Geneva's illustrations when they come back to me. So she makes it possible for me to lighten my story, to cut some of the long explanations of things through those brilliant and very engaging illustrations that she does. I'm so grateful to her.
I'm glad you acknowledged her because they do make an enormous difference, and the two of you are superb partners. This latest book, again from National Geographic, their kids division is Izzy Newton and the Smart Squad, Newton's Flaw, and intended for middle school readers, although I'm not ashamed to admit I enjoyed reading the book myself. And the author, Valerie Tripp. Valerie Tripp, what a delight to reconnect with you. Thank you so much for bringing the world these terrific books, and we look forward to many more.
Thank you so much, Greg. It was a great pleasure to speak to you this morning.
You're listening to The Morning Show on WGTD HD. your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. I'm holding in my hands an absolutely lovely book, both to look at and to read, with a very important theme at its heart. The book is called The Proudest Color. And in this lovely children's book, picture book, we have a central character of Zara, who loves to think of the world around her and her interactions and her own feelings in bright colors. But she is also trying to come to terms with the fact that her skin is brown, unlike the skin color of nearly all of her schoolmates. And so it is kind of a journey that this beautiful youngster goes on. And we follow that journey in this book called The Proudest Color. And the book was created by a gifted couple, Sheila Modir and Jeff Kashu. Sheila Modir is a pediatric psychologist, and Jeffrey Kashu is a marriage and family therapist. And they happen to be Middle Eastern Americans who have worked very tirelessly on various issues related to diversity and equality. And this is their first children's book that they have created together. It's published by Familius, again called The Proudest Color. Sheila Modir and Jeff Kashu, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you so much for having us. We're really excited to be here, Greg.
Good morning. This is a pleasure. Thank you.
It's a lovely, lovely book. It really, really is. So your daily professional lives have nothing, at least directly, to do with creating children's books. So tell me how it occurred to you that this was something that should be done. I mean, that the world needed this book and that the two of you were the ones who should write it.
Yeah, absolutely. So this summer, in the wake of George Floyd's murder and the subsequent protests for social justice across the country, we recognized we had an opportunity to do something, and we weren't quite sure what. And reflecting on our own experiences, especially Sheila's growing up in some rural areas of Illinois, being the only person of color oftentimes in her communities, we recognized that this was just a really good opportunity for us to give children who were watching what was happening, for families who weren't sure how to talk about it with their children, a resource to help them understand and process, but then also to cope and build resilience in the face of it. You know, we understand that we can't stop prejudice and racism and discrimination right away, but we definitely want to be able to control what is in our control, which is how we confront it. And also one thing I do want to mention at the top, if that's okay, is that we are donating our author's proceeds as well to the ACLU and other local social justice organizations here in California. Hmm.
I would love to hear more about whatever personal experiences you were able to draw upon in writing this book. Do any particularly powerful memories come to mind?
Yeah, I think that I actually grew up in Illinois, and I, similar to Zahra, I was one of the few people of brown skin tone in my class growing up. And so I was always aware of my appearances and the inability to blend in. I think in a class photo, you can see me a mile away, that I definitely, you know, with my darker hair and darker skin tone, was standing out amongst my classmates. And so a lot of this book was based off of how I oftentimes, when I write about my experiences for autobiographical statements that I have to do for graduate school and so on, I talk about how I often felt like a crayon that wasn't used as much. And when I was used, I was the brightest color on the page. And I was able to take this experience and become a really good therapist from it, because I'm able to connect with all types of patients and be able to really understand their experiences, because I'm someone that was able to take, maybe I wasn't picked as often, but when I was, I added so much more to the page or to a room. And so when we were sitting down to write, I thought of that experience and I was really able to channel it. I also think that for a lot of Middle Eastern Americans, same with Jeff as well, there after September 11th, discrimination towards this community increased tremendously and continues to increase. And so I think that that was a really formative experience for many of us in the community. And that's the experience that really we draw on when we think about discriminations that we have experienced. Mm-hmm.
I gave the very briefest of summaries of the sort of the essential plot of the story, but why don't you tell the story to our listeners in just a little bit more detail in terms of what this young girl named Zahra experiences.
Of course. So you first meet Zahra. She's described as somebody who sees and feels in color. So we bring in some emotional identification into the book as well, just for a mental health theme. And then as she prepares for her first day of school, she's being put to bed by her mother, and they're discussing how proud they are of all the colors they felt during the day, but especially the one that stays and that they see when they look in the mirror, which is the color brown, and her and her mother admiring the different shades of brown even between them. And when Zahra goes to school the next day, it's her first day, she recognizes that nobody else looks like her. And she pauses for a moment, but then remembers how proud she is of her color. And it instills a sense of confidence in her. Soon after that, a white classmate of hers points out that Zahra doesn't look like anyone else and puts her down for it. And that causes Zahra then to question her pride in her color. And so when she comes home, she tells her parents about this. And her parents then engage her in evidence-based practice called racial socialization, which is socializing her to others in her world who are of her skin tone, who have gone on to do amazing and incredible things in her world, to rebuild that sense of pride in her skin tone and her race and others who look like her.
Can you tell us what it was like to shape this story and the kinds of questions that you wrestled with in terms of exactly how you wanted to explore this story? Because, of course, you had an infinite number of possible choices at every stage, and you were doing this for the first time. So help us understand what the process was like for crafting this book.
I think a children's book is just a whole different area. You know, I'm used to writing dissertations or scholarly articles, so having to sit down and write things of such depth in a developmentally appropriate manner, or in a way that, you know, five-year-olds can understand it or parents can feel comfortable talking about it, was definitely a new avenue for us. So really being able to shape a story that is approachable, relatable, and can really stay with someone. You know, we want it to be memorable because we want this story to be able to elicit change and for children to be able to remember Zahra's journey when they enter their first day of school or when they enter a classroom or a store and they don't feel like anybody else in that room. So really, it was definitely a process to find out how to be able to do this that in the right language.
Yeah, and I'll add to that as well. You know, with the interaction that she has with her classmate who discriminates against her, we had an interesting process even with our editor in determining, you know, how we wanted to close up that story, making it developmentally appropriate. And, you know, it is a children's book at the end of the day, but also not putting the onus on the person of color to heal the story. So we were able to institute some elements of anti-racism as well in that part of the story. So it was fun crafting this book.
I wonder if it was harder than you expected it to be, and I only ask that because I think a lot of people kind of make blithe assumptions about how difficult it is to craft a book for children versus a book written for adults. And obviously, it's shorter, fewer pages, many fewer words, and that sort of thing, and yet it has its own challenges that can be tremendously difficult. Was it for you?
Definitely. I think that's a great question, because you know what the most difficult part was, is who there's so many important and incredible people of color that we wanted to include in this book. So there's a part where Zahra's parents explain to her all the important people that share her skin tone. You know, so we're talking about Barack Obama, Frida Kahlo, Malala Yousafzai, Martin Luther King Jr. And so she is thinking of all of these incredible people and relating to them. And so when Jeff and I were sitting down and writing about each person, you know, Cesar Chavez, there's so many that we could have included. And I think that that was definitely an area of struggle because we wanted to make sure that we represented the entire Brown community. But fortunately, there's so many incredible people to pick from, but unfortunately, we weren't able to put it in all of them in a children's book. So I think that's an area that I wish I could just like have this comprehensive list for children to be able to access because there's so many important people out there.
That's a very moving part of the book, that's for sure. By the way, we would certainly be remiss if we didn't make mention of the talented artist who is responsible for the illustrations. What do you want to tell us about her?
Yeah, Monica is just such a brilliant illustrator. We're so fortunate that Familius found her and shared her with us. You know, she brought in a lot of her own story, her own experience as well. It was just a completely positive experience crafting this story with her. I mean, and we were just blown away every time she came back with something. There's elements in the book, too, that she introduced that we hadn't expected that really elevated the process as well. She made the book very neurodiverse, accessible too for kids who learn a little bit differently. She introduced a path, like a crayon path of color that trails Zahra throughout her story that changes color based on her emotions that she identified earlier on. She also brought in this adorable little cat that's her kind of partner who is with her through all the highs and lows of the story. So we're just so fortunate that Monica took this project on with us and brought it to a level we never really could have imagined.
The book at the very end includes a note to parents and caregivers, which is really a marvelous addition to the proceedings. And I don't remember seeing anything quite like this before in a children's book. Explain what the reader finds here on this page called, again, A Note to Parents and Caregivers.
Yeah, so in this, when we wrote this book, we were really wanting to make sure we had this note because we want to use this book as a tool, or we would like parents to use this book as a tool as they explain race and racism to their child. There really isn't a book out there that really openly and explicitly talks about racism among children in this age group. And so this is very much explicitly an experience happens and skin color is questioned. So we wanted to make sure that parents had a guide to be able to navigate sometimes this difficult or for them sometimes an uncomfortable conversation. And so in this guide, we have some different pointers and tips on how to be able to have this conversation. For example, we don't want parents to feel like they have to talk about everything all at once, you know, to sit the child down and have this deep discussion about racism. This is a conversation that should be ongoing in the home. It should be something that we don't take a colorblind approach, right? There's families that say, you know, we don't see color and we are all in this together, which is not necessarily true. There are groups that are treated historically unfairly and continue to be treated unfairly. So we want families to be able to have these conversations, all of them based in the current reality that we're in, multiple conversations as a child goes through different developmental stages, and to be able to use tools like children's books and even tools like Crayola's skin tone crayons and markers. Those are incredible. Or dolls that portray different races and ethnicities. So to be able to help expose their child to diverse groups. So those are just some of those tips we put in there, and we hope that parents can be able to utilize.
It's a really lovely list. I really think that's neat. A last quick question. You touched on the fact that the period immediately after 9/11 was difficult for people of Middle Eastern descent. I wonder what it has been like for you to experience this 20th anniversary, which was just commemorated. I suspect it might have brought back some difficult memories for you.
Yeah, thank you so much for that question. You know, of course, it's such a mixed day for us because it obviously brings about all the pain and sadness for everyone who was lost so senselessly that day. And additionally, you're just constantly reminded of, you know, I can think back to when I was in high school and, you know, showing up to my different classes and feeling all the eyes on me, or a teacher even asking, you know, what should we do? Should we nuke them? Should we go to war with them? I don't know, it's like, you know, family there. Maybe we should take a different approach. And just that, you know, it kind of bolsters your sense of identity at the same time of also now having to constantly think about how it's brought up in conversation. It's something I can speak for myself. I haven't really shook to this day being Palestinian American and, you know, always wondering, do I mention that fact or not, or do I just say I'm, you know, Middle Eastern or Arab descent?
A difficult day for all of us, and a lot of important lessons we hope have been learned. Will you be writing another children's book together, do you think?
We hope so. We definitely hope that this isn't our last one. We have a lot of different mental health themed messages that we'd like to impart on children. This is, you know, we see this in our therapy offices, so we want to make sure that we're capturing and writing about it for parents.
This book, again, is lovely and called The Proudest Color. It's published by Familius. Its co-authors Sheila Modir and Jeff Kashu. Thank you so much for giving the world this lovely book, and thank you for being part of the morning show today.
Thank you so much for having us.
You're listening to The Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. And now a special treat from the Morning Show archives, an interview that was recorded and initially broadcast back in 2007. Some of you may recall a really fun interview which happened here on the Morning Show a couple of years ago now with an author by the name of Charles D. Cohen, who is without a doubt the world's foremost authority on Ted Geisel, also known as Dr. Seuss. That book called The Seuss, The Whole Seuss, and Nothing But The Seuss. We have Charles D. Cohen with us again on the morning show today, this time to talk about a special 50th anniversary edition of one of Dr. Seuss's greatest classics, How the Grinch Stole Christmas. Charles D. Cohen, we welcome you to the morning show.
Well, thank you very much for that introduction, Greg. I had a great time speaking with you last time about that book. That occasion was the 100th anniversary of Ted's birth, and now we've got the 50th anniversary of one of his most famous creations, as you said.
And it is great to be revisiting this work in its original form and then to enjoy this wonderful retrospective at the end of the book in which we hear a lot about the background. I wonder if you would explain to our listeners one of the first things we see in that retrospective at the back of the book on pages 54 and 55. We see at the bottom of the page a strip of 8 different covers of this classic, How the Grinch Stole Christmas. Tell our listeners what I'm talking about and what that says about this story.
Thank you very much again. Yes, what I found was, as I was doing research about this, was the surprising number of languages that this book has been translated into. It was translated into Icelandic, into Hungarian, Japanese, and down at the bottom of the area you're talking about are several of these different editions. And it's interesting, too. Of course, he's not called the Grinch. I think in Japanese, he's Gurinichi. And in Iceland, it's it's Trolli. And in Hungary, it's Gorcs. So he's become a well-known figure, not just where we know about him here, but all over the world.
As we learn from your previous book, so many of the creations that we've come to know and love by Dr. Seuss often had kind of long gestation periods in which he would maybe get the kernel of an idea and it would come to life in various forms and in kind of different stages before finally emerging. Tell us just how circuitous a route it was in this case from original idea to final flowering.
You put that so perfectly. I could have used you writing the book. That was wonderful. he had a phenomenal memory, Ted Geisel. And things would stick there. He would get an image or a thought, and he might work it out in one of his cartoons. He used to be a cartoonist and an advertising man. And then, I think completely unaware, they would just sit there for maybe 2 decades and then blossom later. In this case, the first inkling I really saw of a Grinch character was back in the late 20s. He was combining several different things that children told their parents about. The parents told their children about. Things like the Sandman or the Boogeyman and the Santa Claus and the stork bringing children. And he said it was too much for kids to really remember and that we should roll them all into one. And so he drew this image of a stork with antlers, and he's delivering a Santa Claus, which is also a combination of the Boogeyman, you know, to someone's roof. And I think that Santa Claus boogeyman image was probably the first idea of what a Grinch would be like. And then, and you're talking almost exactly 30 years later when the book finally comes out. Now, in between, he continued to play with various ideas about the images that we have of Christmas, what would bring Santa, you know, how would you change a reindeer, what else would you use. In the book, we used a couple of the Christmas cards that he made for family back in the 30s, and in one of them, there's a series of five of the typical Susian beasts delivering Santa, and him saying, after all, reindeer are so common. You know, he would play with these various images, and so I tried in the book to show that development, how the Grinch went from this boogeyman Santa into an advertisement for Holly Sugar, which is the first time you see a Grinch looking like the Grinch we know, taking Max and having him evolve from a dachshund with deer with antlers into the animal that we know with the antlers being tied on. And the same thing for the Who's, for example. Mm.
It's really interesting, too, to look at some of those early examples of a character called the Grinch. I mean, to see Dr. Seuss use the term Grinch not to describe the specific character that we know from this story. I mean, sometimes it'll be a relatively pleasant-looking character that will be called a Grinch for whatever reason. That it takes us a moment to get over the shock of that.
Well, this is the fun of this part of my job. I get to find out of all these things. The first time that he used the word Grinch, it actually referred to a bird. There's a bald-headed Grinch that sits on a rock, and it's in the book Scrambled Egg Super from, I think it's 1953. The main character walks by, and that bird isn't laying eggs that day. So it was a completely different thing. And then he shows up a couple of years later in a story called The Hubbub and the Grinch, and this is another pleasure in doing a retrospective like this, is that people have probably never heard of The Hubbub and the Grinch, and we get to show people that story. But at that time, a Grinch was developing this sort of nasty streak. Basically, it was someone who sells people things that they don't need. In this case, a piece of green string that he convinces someone to buy, or rather a hubbub to buy. And then at the same year that he's having a Grinch sell people things they don't need, that's when he draws this Grinch character that we think of, and he's selling people sugar. He tended to do this where he didn't think so much about the interplay between the two, the commentary.
Mm. Of course, for a lot of people, they know this story best either from the most recent live-action feature film, or maybe even more likely from the magnificently rendered animated special from the mid-1960s. I suppose in either case, if that's how you primarily know this story, it's going to be a real revelation, in a sense, to pick up this book and read the story in its original form, although it really shows us how true the animated special was to this original work.
It's part of I find fascinating the evolution. You know, when I went into this, I had forgotten that the Grinch had shown up pretty much every decade as a reimagined, slightly different-looking character. When you ask someone what color is the Grinch, they automatically say green. We all think of him as green. But when you look at the book, you realize that he was originally black and white with pink eyes and occasionally that red Santa suit. So the 1966 special that you're referring to that he did with Chuck Jones, in some ways almost supplanted this in the general consciousness that people have. But when you go back, this is still very endearing. There's something charming about this original. It was interesting. He was able to do such a fantastic job with Chuck Jones because they had worked together already in the Army on films. So they had a rapport. That one, Ted's main contribution was all of these lyrics for these wonderful songs sung by Thurl Ravenscroft. But people may not be aware, just like they wouldn't know about the Hubbub and the Grinch, but the Grinch in 1977 appeared in a story for television called Halloween is Grinch Night, which won an Emmy. And then in 1982, there was a story called The Grinch Grinches the Cat in the Hat, which also won two Emmys. And Ted wrote both of the scripts for those. And then, of course, people know him from the 2000 movie with Jim Carrey. So this is part of what adds to his popularity. The original book people can read now. His messages are still timely, still relevant, but also people have seen it. You know, new generations have seen it in ways that are comfortable for them.
Hmm. I think in your retrospective, you really point out kind of an interesting point, which is that, you know, here you are really doing a lot of research about Dr. Seuss, and in this case, really carefully tracing the emergence of this work and the way in which it's been transformed over the years. You point out quite rightly that there are people that have done PhD theses on how the Grinch Stole Christmas and other Dr. Seuss works. And you share with us something that Ted Geisel said at one point upon when confronted with that that reality, that people were putting his works under such a careful sort of microscope.
Yeah, it's an odd position to be in. I always keep in mind that the quotation you're talking about where people asked him about that, and he would say how people would do this thesis about his particular use of a color, you know, a single color. And, you know, I've read these things, whether they be in theses or just in critiques, and people will go on and on about a particular color, and then he'll point out that it had nothing to do with that. It was that Random House was having a little tough time financially at the time and told him to cut down his number of colors. So I'm always aware of drawing conclusions. And it was a very risky thing to do, even if you listened to interviews that he did or read interviews, because he was such a great storyteller. All he cared about was amusing people, that he didn't always tell the truth. So, you know, you have to, this is my job, is to go back to the first-hand sources, sort through the stories he told or the things that we've come to think about him, and get back to what really had happened.
Hmm. It's interesting, too. You quote his memoirs where Ted Geisel said, "It's the product that's the most important, not the process of how it was created." It's so ironic that he said that because, in fact, your magnificent first book, The Seuss, The Whole Seuss and Nothing But the Seuss, is almost entirely taken up with that process. And we're so glad you disregarded Ted Geisel's thoughts on that because, I mean, really, it only enhances our appreciation of the final product when we understand the process by which it was created.
Well, I appreciate that analysis and your incredible memory about the previous book. It's true. I think that both are true. I think what he was trying to get at was that in the end, as the artist, what he wants to see is the final product. He wants to see that this is something people can enjoy, that the artwork came out well. I mean, this was agonizing for him. We look at a book and we say, you know, it's only got 200 lines in it. You know, how long can that have taken to write this children's book? But he would agonize for a year and painstakingly to try to get down that rhythm we think of as Dr. Seuss, you know, that particular lilt to the language was just such an effort for him. And, you know, that when that's all done, you want to know that that's what you want people to focus on. He didn't care about the process. But, you know, when afterwards, I mean, that's fine when the book first comes out, but, you know, you and I, I'm sure, and many of your listeners have enjoyed these books. Well, here we are 50 years. It's also interesting for those of us who want to go beyond that to find out, where do these things come from? You know, for him, it's hard in an interview. He had a thing he would tell people, if there's this place called Zabilnikov, you know, near the Swiss Alps, and he would go there every year to get his cuckoo clock fixed, and this is where he got his ideas for his books. I mean, he would just make things like that up because he didn't want to have to answer the questions. That was tedious. What he wanted to do was talk about the work. But for us now, it's fascinating, and I don't think he knew. I don't think he realized that the images that we see had occurred to him earlier. That wasn't of interest to him, but I think now if he could read them and go, geez, you know what, I completely forgot about that. And at the risk of running on in this, I had just spoken with his agent, Herb Cheyette, who delivered at Ted Geisel's memorial, a wonderful story. I don't know if we have time for the whole story, but basically the point of the story was about Ted deciding that rather than being paid the most money per word, he would rather turn down the most money per word. And this story was about a piece that we included in this book. It was called A Prayer for a Child. But at the time, they didn't even know that that had been published. This is his own agent, and Ted didn't remember writing that piece. It was a complete surprise to him when he saw that. The person who told the anecdote in 1991 at the memorial told me he didn't know that that was the piece until he read the previous book you were talking about in 2004. So, you know, Ted just, he did these things. He did such a massive amount of work that a lot of it would have been unfamiliar to him, and that's why it's worth doing these things and showing the process, as you had said.
Well, we're glad you did it, and we're so glad to have this 50th anniversary edition of How the Grinch Stole Christmas. And Charles D. Cohen, a great pleasure to speak with you again. Happy holidays to you.
Thank you so much, Greg. It's a pleasure talking to you.
Thank you.
Tomorrow on the morning show, we will be, among other things, offering up a preview of this weekend's concert by the Kenosha Symphony Orchestra, back performing in front of live audiences, albeit with COVID protocols in place to try to keep everybody safe. And we'll be talking with Peter Rodriguez about Saturday afternoon's concert called Christmas with the Kenosha Symphony. Friday's morning show will feature a conversation with Tim Giel, talking about his fascinating book, Stanley, The Impossible Life of Africa's Greatest